You don't have to believe in climate change to want to support energy R&D investment. The jobs of the future are not going to be in the fossil fuel sector. They're going to be in the renewable sector, and they're going to be there in America and not in China if we are making these technologies more affordable here through new investment in R&D.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Civios podcast. In this episode, we're talking with Gabe Chan, assistant professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs in the area of science, technology, and environmental policy. So, welcome.
Thanks.
Can you talk a little bit about how you got here and what motivated you to get into this area of research?
I was an undergraduate in climate science, and I was really into the physics and the chemistry of how the atmosphere worked. You know, really interested, passionate about the way the climate system worked in particular. And sort of as I progressed in my scientific training, sort of got to the point where the problems of climate change just became so clear to me. And I felt like I could push the frontier in where we were going on climate science, you know, getting that fifth decimal place on what temperature change is going to be under continued human emissions. And I felt like if I pursued that career and kept going on the scientific frontier, that it was going to be another voice in a loud crowd where the message was already so clear to me as a scientist. So I made a transition about halfway through my undergraduate education into thinking more about the politics of this problem. What are the policies that you can actually do something? Because I felt as a scientist, there wasn't really anything I could do that could really advance this cause. The science was just already so clear. So I started to think about what public policies made sense given what I had learned in the science. And I explored many different ways to approach this, and I got really lucky with a summer internship at the U.S. Department of Energy. And it was such a transformative experience to see a big group of engineers and scientists who, like me, had a lot of technical training in sort of the natural science of the problem, the engineering of energy technologies, and we're all thinking about how to connect that to practice. So after a few months at the Department of Energy, I came back to my college and kept working, then combining a degree in both the natural and political science, and started to think more about how you design policies, but also the economics of those policies, and then really have continued down that path since then.
What is the history of government involvement in funding research and development in energy?
Well, if we go back to the very beginning of when the public sector really started ramping up its effort in science in general, you have to go back to the end of World War II, or really the middle of World War II, during the process to build the atomic bomb during the so-called Manhattan Project, the government got really mobilized in tapping into some of the best scientists in the world to take a, you know, sort of out there physics concepts and really bring that into direct engineering application within the span of only 2 to 3 years. That led to the development of nuclear bombs. But that was a real public sector effort. And then, you know, that created this huge system of national laboratories. You may have heard of the Los Alamos National Laboratory or the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Those all were founded through the Manhattan Project. They were secret military public sector bases where some of the best scientists in the world came. Then after World War II, there was a big question of what do we do with this? You know, we've now shown that the government can lead the role in taking this brand new out there science and create new technologies that have really big impacts, sort of being agnostic about what you think about nuclear bombs. I think just from a scientific technological standpoint, that was a really incredible mobilization of science led by the public sector for a public goal. So thinking about after World War II, we had to think about what are we going to do with this amazing capacity we've discovered for the public interest. So there was a move to bring more science into the public sector, to think about how to do this maybe in other areas like in health. physics research, or in energy in this case. So there was originally ERDA, the Energy Research and Development Administration, that eventually turned into the Department of Energy around the time of the Arab oil embargo in the 1970s. And we saw a big push following the huge spike in gas prices around that period, where we started to see more calls from the public to now bring energy research into the public sector. And we saw a lot of research into early stage solar and other alternatives for energy. This has now evolved, and the Department of Energy has been a cabinet level position for 40 plus years now. So that's the basic history of it, sort of emerging from World War II, big mobilization of science, discovering alternative ways to use this new capacity and sort of demonstrated potential for the public sector in research and development.
What does government energy R&D funding look like now?
It's mostly controlled through the Department of Energy. It depends how you break it down, but I would say on the order, a good approximation is about $5 billion per year across different kinds of energy R&D. There's a lot of basic R&D into things like the chemistry of batteries or advanced biology for biofuels. Things that happen in the laboratory, sort of what you think of when you think of a scientist in the lab. But there's also a lot of very interesting ways to connect the dot between that basic science and the more applied science. Now, that distinction is also very fuzzy and also potentially problematic, but sort of if you sort of want to caricaturize what government involvement in science looks like, the government is involved in many stages of technology development, from the very concept early parts all the way through things like building demonstration projects of new technologies. So actually going out there and saying, we're going to do a public-private partnership to try out a brand new technology that's never been tried before and see if it works. So it takes many different forms. We invest in many different technology areas as well. The Department of Energy invests in a whole bunch of renewables, energy efficiency, nuclear, advanced fossil energy like carbon capture or clean coal you may have heard of. And it really runs the spectrum there.
Are there a few examples that you have of particular successes of investment in R&D in the United States?
There are a lot of successes. I think, you know, depends how far back you want to go. I think one, when we look at successes, one really hard part of evaluating something like R&D is that you need to try a whole bunch of things before something is successful. You know, a 1 in 10 rate of being successful is actually a really good thing in government R&D. And so what are the successes? You know, you have to think about programmatic successes. What kind of approaches have been successful? So you look at the very early stages of things like solar photovoltaics. You know, these technologies were developed really early, actually, in the private sector at a place called Bell Labs, which has sort of evolved into AT&T's parent company. But at Bell Labs, they developed this initial concept, but the first applications were actually public sector applications in satellites. So this was really driven by the public sector. And the government has continued to invest very heavily in advanced photovoltaics, and you can sort of see those traces of ways that that's entered into actual applications. Bringing it more to home to what people might actually know about, the fracking revolution, which many people have been affected by, especially in this part of the country, has really had its seeds in initial public sector investment back in the 70s and 80s. So it's really hard to draw a direct line between public investment and actual applications. The National Academies, which is sort of the most prestigious collection of academics, went back and did a retrospective study of Department of Energy investments over the whole lifetime of the Department of Energy, so 40 plus years. They found that actually the return on investment from DOE investments was actually positive, but almost all of those benefits were coming from just a few number of programs. So it's kind of a very bizarre set of public investments. If this kind of logic was applied to any other area of government investment, you would think this is a terrible investment. If we're only getting our return out of 10% of our projects, or we're wasting 90% of our money, let's just target those 10%. But with R&D, you have to remember that you don't know if things are going to work out at the beginning. That's the whole point. If you knew it was going to work out, then the private sector should do it. If you knew it was going to have a return, leave that for the private sector. But we're talking about very uncertain investments at the beginning. And so how to think about success here is really hard. You want a portfolio that only succeeds 1 out of 10 times. And from that metric, the DOE has actually done quite well.
What are some alternatives for government investment? For example, government funding for private companies to do energy R&D.
Yeah, so the government does provide a tax credit for the private sector to do R&D. So that incentivizes private actors to take on R&D. But the big problem with that kind of alternative to public sector direct investment R&D is that the private sector is much more risk averse than the public sector, meaning that the private sector is not going to take a big gamble that will only pay off 1 in 10 times. They're much more concerned about their year to year or maybe 3-year timescale returns and something that they can go report to shareholders, yes, they're making a whole bunch of smart investments. The public sector is different. They're not accountable to shareholders, and so they can take bigger risks. And I think that's the real key, is that there's no other entity anywhere in the economy that can take as big of a risk in terms of probability, so going after those moonshots, or as the Department of Energy calls it now, the sunshot to develop really cheap solar energy, and also do it in a way with a lot of investment. Only the public sector can put $1 million behind a project or, $500 million behind a project that may or may not pan out, and also one that may not pan out for 10 years. So I think for all those reasons, there is no clear alternative to the public sector really getting engaged. Now, there's many different ways the public sector can engage in R&D. And I think that's where we're seeing some really innovative public policies now is, can we get more bang for our buck in terms of how we're spending the taxpayer dollar? And this has led to new kinds of approaches. So one of the new approaches developed early in the Obama administration, or first implemented actually at the beginning of the Obama administration, was a so-called loan guarantee program, where rather than investing millions of dollars, instead the government backed a loan to a company and said, we're just going to reduce the risk of your financing. And so this was a way to get a much larger flow of capital to a R&D project that the government chose.
Can you talk a little bit about what your research tells us about government energy R&D investment?
Yeah, so my research has focused on a few key areas that I see as really room for academic research to improve the process. So one area I focused on is, how do you actually manage the organizations who implement these decisions? So the Department of Energy oversees 17 national laboratories. These national labs, as I mentioned earlier, many of them have their history in the Manhattan Project. Some of them are newer, but most of them have their history in the Manhattan Project, and they're implementing a lot of the Department of Energy R&D projects. So these 17 labs, we've thought about, how do you actually make these work? And a big challenge here is that this is the public sector managing a large enterprise. And anyone who's been to the DMV knows how these can get really inefficient if you don't think about how to make them work. And so there's a room for research here to think about what kind of relationships make sense. How do you align incentives so that scientists who work at these labs actually are working in the public interest? Or that the products, the scientific products like the new inventions, how do you get those into use so that the public benefits them from them? So that's where my research is focused in part, is how do you make these labs overseen by the Department of Energy work better in the public interest? Another area where I've really focused my research on is thinking about, how do you design a portfolio of investments that actually balances risks across the portfolio, that takes calculated risks where there is public return, but also thinks about the complementarities of those investments so that we're not putting all our eggs in one basket, but that we're thinking about how to manage these really big risks sometimes. And through that process of thinking about how do you balance risks, a key thing that we have repeatedly pointed out is things can change depending on what your criteria for decision-making is. And one of the things that we have emphasized is that the criteria should be what energy investments work in the public interest, and in particular, the public interest when you start to include environmental benefits, that you may make a different set of investments if you are only maximizing on getting these technologies into the marketplace and into use, when as opposed to getting these into use in a way that reduces our carbon dioxide emissions.
Who is the audience for your research?
Our primary audience for our research has really been threefold. I think one is the public, to understand what is going on with our taxpayer dollars. Two has been the management of DOE and the labs to think about, you know, how could they change their decision-making process internally. And three has been Congress. How can they design laws that reshape the incentives and relationships to work better?
With the public trying to understand what's going on, why should they care about this research?
Well, they should care because it's their taxpayer money at work. And they should care because energy innovation is going to shape our future, that, you know, we are living in a world of a changing climate. The biggest contributor to our greenhouse gas emissions is from the energy sector. And how we make this transition from a primarily fossil fuel-based economy to a primarily non-fossil fuel-based economy is going to depend so much on what technologies are available. At the end of the day, we can tax fossil fuels, we can subsidize renewable energy, but those are costly, that in the long run, the only real way to make progress towards mitigating our greenhouse gas emissions is to make it so much cheaper to do so than to not do so, to make renewables cheaper than coal without taxes or subsidies. That's the end game of energy innovation policy.
Why should the new administration, which is prioritizing spending cuts in federal programs, resist calls to cut the budget of the Department of Energy's R&D programs?
I think it depends how important the politics of this end up being. I think if there's a lot of public pressure to do something on climate change, that the Trump administration could really see energy R&D investment as a kind of win-win for them. This was certainly the case under the Bush administration, where energy R&D was actually a major strategy to please the environmental community. That the stance then, which is very similar to the stance emerging now, is that the climate is changing, but we're not sure how much influence there is from human activity. So the safest course of action is to start to develop new technologies that maybe in 10 years can address the problem if we do more science. Now, this is not truly representative of how the scientific community views the problem of climate change, but this is a very convenient political stance to not take on costly environmental regulations and instead pursue solutions that someone else will have to implement. And so I think we might see the Trump administration continue on clean energy R&D investment as a way to appear like they are taking a comprehensive stance on climate change mitigation. So there it could become politically convenient to continue this kind of activity. I think the real reason, though, that they should continue investing in energy R&D investment is that these are long-term problems that need long-term solutions, and R&D projects cannot be started and stopped year to year. It takes a long time to develop a new project, to develop a new technology. You can't bring funding in at $200 million a year, 1 year, and then take it away. That is going to undermine the whole enterprise, the initial investment in that project. And so there's going to be a lot of waste if these projects are rolled back immediately. But more importantly, you know, these technologies take a long time to materialize, and they eventually go into the economy and save people money. They go out, new, more efficient refrigerators, air conditioners. You know, these technologies save people money, and it's good for the economy. Now, you know, we know just in our home state of Minnesota, in the last 15 years, 7,000 jobs were created in the renewable energy sector. This is completely outweighing the jobs created in the fossil fuel sector. And so it's good for the economy to continue developing these technologies, but it also requires a long-term perspective. And I think that's going to be the big challenge when advocates try to convince the Trump administration to not take the actions that they have talked about to cut DOE spending. That, you know, if we're thinking about long-term economic growth over the next 10, 20 years, the jobs of the future are not going to be in the fossil fuel sector. They're going to be in the renewable sector, and they're going to be there in America and not in China if we are making these technologies more affordable here through new investment in R&D. You don't have to believe in climate change to want to support energy R&D investment. And I think that's the kind of magic politics here, is that the jobs are there, it makes economic sense, and the environmental piece of this, for some people, is the end-all be-all. But it's not even necessary at this point where technologies have developed to really see the economic case for continuing these investments.
. 2016 was the hottest year on record, followed by 2015 and then 2014. Many scientists in the media have said that we're already too late to avert the worst effects of climate change. Shouldn't we be devoting our resources towards doing as much as we can to reduce greenhouse gas emissions right now? Why should we be investing in energy technologies that won't materialize in 5, 10, or even 20 years, when we could be spending that money on building new solar or wind energy?
That's a great question. Climate change is an urgent problem. We are already too late to avert the worst consequences. But I think one of the things about climate change is that it's a cumulative problem. You know, we're on track to have global temperature increase more than 2 degrees Celsius. If we don't do anything, it's going to be even more. And I think that's the key thing, is that, you know, 2 degrees has been set by a lot of policymakers as the threshold for when the impacts become really bad. It's a sort of fuzzy line. But, you know, what science shows us is that 3 degrees is worse than 2 degrees, and 4 degrees is worse than 3 degrees, and 5 degrees is worse than 4 degrees. And so, you know, because of this, because there is no real clear red line in when we're in a safe climate or a dangerous climate, that the impacts get worse and worse and worse as emissions continue to increase, we need to also be thinking about long-term solutions. And another, you know, piece of the science that informs my thinking on this is that CO2, carbon dioxide, stays in the atmosphere for 1,000 years approximately. So it's up there irreversibly, essentially, in any of our lifetimes, that everything that we're emitting now and everything that we've emitted for the last 1,000 years is still up there in the atmosphere contributing to global warming, and that it doesn't matter when you reduce. All that matters is the total amount that's been put up there. And so because of that, you know, it's a long-term problem. We also need long-term solutions. We need to take urgent action now, but we also need to think about setting ourselves up for a long-term path to really get our emissions down to zero. And I think the other key reason we need to be thinking on not just a short timeline, but also a long timeline, is that there are many places in the world that are still extremely poor that are on their way up. And as they develop, as countries in Africa, as India continues this rapid development, they're going to be looking to new sources of energy. And they're not going to be asking the question of, you know, what's good for the global climate. They're going to be asking the question of, how do I get out of poverty as quickly as possible? And the answer to that question is always going to be whatever is cheapest to make this happen. And if the answer to that question in 10 years, when Africa is asking this question, is still coal, well, that's going to be really bad for long-term emissions. So I think because of all these reasons, we need to be thinking not just on that short timeline. Yes, it's an urgent problem, but also this problem is going to get more and more urgent in the next 10, 20, and 50 years.
So how do you stress the importance of investment in energy innovation to the group of the public who doesn't believe in the human role in climate change?
I think you just need to make the economic argument over and over and over again. The jobs are in new renewable energy. They're not in coal mining anymore. I think, you know, one of the striking things about the U.S. coal sector is that we have basically maintained flat levels of coal production over the last 10, 15 years. There's been a recent decline, but it's basically been flat. But the jobs have come way down. And that's because we've gotten really good at mechanizing, you know, things like mountaintop removal. You know, there are jobs there, but they're not very many jobs. It's a lot of big shovels doing things. And so, you know, we're seeing a transition in how we do fossil energy that's pulling away from jobs, even though it's not, you know, reducing overall levels of production right now. Whereas in renewable energy, there isn't really a way to mechanize putting solar panels on your roof or building new wind turbines. That the jobs are going to be there in the future. And so I think we really just need to emphasize this economic case. If you get away from the Trump administration for a few minutes, globally, air pollution is a real major problem in China and India right now. If you go and Google what it looks like in Beijing or Shanghai or Mumbai right now, compared to what it looked like 20 years ago, you know, it's night and day. Almost literally, it looks like night during the day in these cities. There's so much air pollution. And it's become a political problem. It's no longer about the environment. It's about how the people feel about their governments, that they really feel disappointed that they have to wear face masks, that they have to keep their children inside. And so I think it's starting to become a political issue in these countries, and they no longer see this as an environmental issue, and they're taking a lot of action. China has announced a $300 billion investment over the next 3 years in renewable energy. This is really, in my mind, a completely politically driven local problem for them. And as a side effect, it's going to start reducing our global greenhouse gas emissions, and that's a good thing.
A lot of listeners have probably seen the headlines over the past few years about DOE projects going horribly wrong. Take, for example, Solyndra, which received millions of dollars of government support in the Obama administration before going bankrupt and then being subjected to federal investigation. Why should we trust the public sector to invest in projects that are in the public interest?
Well, that's a really good question. I think Solyndra has gotten a lot of attention. But I think to contextualize Solyndra a little bit also, the program that Solyndra emerged from was the loan guarantee program that I mentioned earlier. This is a program. It's not a direct grant from the Department of Energy. It's instead the Department of Energy selecting a project and backing the finance for it, so lowering the financial risk. But that program, the loan guarantee program, actually now, in total, if you look across all the projects, has deposited money into the Treasury, meaning it's revenue positive. There are very few government programs that actually raise money. And so you look at where we stand now with the program that funded Solyndra, it actually has done very well for the taxpayers, actually brought back in money. It's also supported highly successful companies like Tesla. People don't appreciate this as much in the public sector when things go really right, that Tesla actually got a loan guarantee and paid it back early and is now producing or has promised to produce some of the most affordable electric cars on the market. So what went wrong with Solyndra? Solyndra was a political problem because it was a solar company that went bankrupt. And in the investigations that followed, there were some, you know, very unsavory, unethical things that sort of happened in the back doors there. But the overall principle that we should have some government-backed projects go bankrupt or fail in other ways, that actually in and of itself is not a bad thing. I think the hardest thing about how we organize the public sector to invest in energy innovation is to create a way to allow for those failures. That failing is actually really important because, you know, as I said a little bit earlier, if government projects don't fail, then they're not doing anything useful because the private sector could take those risks. That government investment should be risky up front. So they're doing something different. They're, you know, high risk, high reward. That's the kind of model that we need in publicly supported energy innovation. And so we need to allow for those failures. We shouldn't allow for the kinds of failures from bad politics. We need to have better oversight. We need a strong inspector general looking over these projects to make sure that things aren't happening unethically, because it is a really big challenge. These are, you know, public sector workers selecting projects to receive taxpayer money or backing in other ways. And that's a big, hard problem. And we need to get the institutions right. We need to get the oversight right on those. But at the end of the day, the fact that some projects fail is a good thing. And we need to figure out how to make those politics work.
Are there any emerging areas or new projects that you're really excited about?
Yeah, one of the things I'm really excited about in this field is this new-ish 2009, where it really got money and it started going a little bit after that, organization within the Department of Energy. It's called ARPA-E, which stands for Advanced Research Project Agency for Energy. And it's modeled after DARPA. And maybe some of the listeners have heard of DARPA, which is responsible for some of those really out there, crazy inventions that then turned out to enter our life every day, like GPS or touchscreens and things like that. ARPA-E is modeled after DARPA to take these really high risk, really high return, kind of out there, moonshot kind of investments. And it's really exciting to see that kind of approach taken in energy. And so they have already started to fund these projects that are doing new approaches to solar energy, new approaches to bioenergy, even new approaches to nuclear energy and modeling how we do that. And so it's a really exciting sort of approach to thinking about how we structure our investments. Can we do this in a way that really is really high risk, really high return? And what's neat about ARPA-E is that it's insulated from the rest of DOE. It actually operates independently and has a direct line to the Secretary of Energy. So there's less oversight, more control by the scientists. And the way they avoid some of these big problems of other public institutions or this picking winners problem is they kick everyone out of the organization in 3 years. And so you cannot get ingrained in this sort of mindset. And they're pulling people in from the world of venture capital. They're pulling in some of the best scientists to come and work in this organization, help select projects, and then get out of there after 3 years. And so it creates this very dynamic, exciting way to think about how we invest our public dollars.
So looking forward, what are you hopeful for?
So I reached peak hope around December 2015. This was when the Paris Agreement was signed, where every country in the world got together and agreed to aim for 2 degrees Celsius and do it in a way that was politically feasible. And every country came forward with their commitment to do more on climate. In parallel to the Paris Agreement, at the Paris conference where they signed this agreement, there was also a side agreement amongst the world's largest economies to double their investment in energy R&D in 5 years. This was super exciting for people who think about the world like I do and see energy innovation as a key part of the climate problem, that you actually had all the world leaders together with major private sector leaders like Bill Gates up on the stage celebrating this commitment to doubling energy R&D investment. I was really hopeful at that point. That commitment is still on the table. And what I'm hopeful for now is that the world continues on that path to seeing this problem of climate change, not just in the frame of costs and benefits and how do we make this system fair for developed and developing countries, but also with technology at the heart of it, with ways to think about developing new technologies that are in the public interest. And, you know, looking forward, I sort of see glimmers of hope around the world. You know, as I mentioned, this Chinese pledge to spend over $300 billion in renewable energy, that makes me very hopeful. The way Europe approaches renewable energy, or parts of Europe, I think Germany's approach to solar energy makes me very hopeful. I think also sort of see glimmers of hope now in places in some of the most developing countries, some of the poorest countries like India, parts of Africa, are really adopting solar energy in a big way as part of their strategy to develop their economy without ruining the environment. And I think those areas give me hope.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.